Vassil Harvey, and I'm going to invite everyone to adopt arguments that have already been made to the extent that that makes sense. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon, Honorable Justices. Thank you for permitting the New Jersey Association for Justice to appear as amicus curiae in this matter. The New Jersey Association of Justice asked this court to reverse the appellate division's decision in this matter. The appellate division erred in adding a word that didn't exist to the statute. Under Section 41, the plain language does not include an and, it's or, specialty or subspecialty. Defendants take the equitable remedy in Buck versus Henry of Rule 4:5-3 and turn it into an inequity. All that was required, as Justice Fischel mentioned, is the specialty and if the treatment was involved in that specialty. Here, the affidavit of merit that was submitted met that requirement because he certified, DA 71, the defendant doctor, certified in paragraph 5, all treatment was both an internist and a gastroenterologist. So under the plain reading of the statute, the affidavit of merit was proper in this case. The legislature did not require an and. It did not require that it be kind for all kinds. It's kind for kind. It doesn't say mirror the defendant exactly. It could have said that, but it didn't. And it also didn't use an and to connect the phrase specialist and subspecialist.
Does the legislative language really address multiple specialties?
So in terms of, it's not very well written.
I'm wondering if we can really find our guidance in the legislative language.
I think we can, because when you're looking at the testimony, the person providing the testimony shall have specialized at the time of the occurrence that is the basis for the action in the same specialty or subspecialty recognized by the American Board of American Specialties or the American Osteopathic Association as the party against whom or on whose behalf the testimony is offered, and if the person against whom or on whose behalf the testimony is being offered is board certified and the care or treatment at issue involves that board specialty or subspecialty recognized by the American Board of Medical Specialties or the American Osteopathic Association, the expert shall be, and then goes through the qualifications. So I think if they wanted it to be a mirror, they could have clarified that it could have been, or if there's subspecialties, he has to meet all of them. Like they could have added additional language, but they didn't. They only linked it together with the or. And I think that's very important because there can be a breach as an internist that's not a breach as to something else here, potentially gastro. So the when you're looking at the in Haviland, at 250 NJ 368, page 378, the 2022 decision, this court said, focus on the underlying conduct. So here, you can have it be a breach that the primary care physician who's in charge of this patient's overall health and well-being, that their error in this prescription was under the internal medicine. And that goes to plaintiff, how plaintiff is couching the argument. You don't, and then when there's the defense, he can raise the defense. Well, no, I'm providing care as a gastroenterologist. Here he says both. He doesn't just say, I'm the gastroenterologist. He says both.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to.
No, go ahead.
Do you think that any ambiguity could be solved by amending the specialty statement rule to require more specificity?
I don't think that the rule itself, I think the rule itself is very helpful for a plaintiff to know what the specialty is. The problem is when we have a factual dispute as exists here, which is why I had attempted to come up with a framework for how this court could resolve that issue. So based upon the record that exists before this court, I think that under my framework, it would make clear that this plaintiff has gotten beyond the threshold. So as long as there is some evidence under Rule 1:6-6 that is put forth in response to a notice of motion to dismiss, then the plaintiff goes forward. This court in
some evidence Buck, of yes, what? Some evidence.
Some evidence that the care as to what specialty is involved and that the affidavit of merit meets that specialty. So here, if it's this is internal medicine, but not gastroenterology. Here, the plaintiff put forth both an internist who is able to give that opinion that this is internal medicine. And in fact, she does. She goes into great detail that she says that this is not a gastroenterological issue. It's a urinary issue, and that she's not aware of any gastro purpose. Then on the other hand, this plaintiff also put forth proofs from certifications from gastroenterologists to say they're not aware of when this medicine would be prescribed in the field of gastroenterology. So if we adopt this framework that I'm suggesting, it would be in tandem with the rule as written. But at the Ferrero conference, what you're supposed to do, and Buck says, you decide, is it sufficient or not? Here, the trial court said that unless there's a certification saying they're only practicing gastroenterology, this affidavit of merit is sufficient. That's what happened at the Ferrero conference, which is what this court said should happen. We should have a resolution at the Ferrero conference. So it presumably worked, but then the problem was when we went down the road and once leave to appeal was granted, the appellate division reverses on a legal question. And that's the problem that I think that under this framework, we need
the situation where I understand this is somewhat of an unusual case in that we're dealing with prescription and that's it in this case, from what the plaintiff tells us. But what about a situation where there is protracted treatment in two specialties, which are closely related? Obviously, one is a subspecialty of the other. And there's certainly nothing pre-discovery to exclude one or the other. And the doctor says, I treated her or him for as both an internist and a gastroenterologist.
I think under that hypothetical, that plaintiff can choose that I'm only going to pursue the one claim. It might be that they were practicing in both, but my claim that I'm bringing is as to the one. And plaintiff can do that.
What is the procedural mechanism for the plaintiff doing that? Because at this point, you have a complaint filed. You've got the affidavit of merit time period. But what does the plaintiff do to establish that they've limited their claim to one or the other?
I think it's in the complaint.
Sorry?
It's in the complaint itself. So that the claim that is brought, you have fact pleading so that you're putting the other side on notice of the basics of your claim. And if the contention is that the treatment was limited to one specialty, you're going to give the affidavit of merit within that specialty. But so if there's another one,
tell me if I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that most med mal complaints say the patient's decedent was treated X period by this doctor, and the doctor deviated from the standard of care, and obviously causation language after that. Are you saying that if plaintiffs were more precise, perhaps in your complaints you are, that would resolve the issue?
No, I think that when we look at it, it goes to, it's how the case is going to unfold. So you have your complaint, you're going to file your affidavit of merit. You can have the Ferrero conference at day 90 where you're going to discuss, is it compliant? So at that conference is when the defense can raise any issues and they have to tell us why there are issues. So ordinarily this doesn't become an issue.
Right. But so you're saying instead of requiring it to be in the complaint, it's something that's really hashed out with the judge at the Ferrero conference?
Really, that's how it should be, because that's the whole point of Ferrero, so that we can address issues early and prevent this misstep of having a complaint that's meritorious dismissed with prejudice, because it's a nail in the coffin that we want to try to avoid. And that's why the framework that I'm suggesting, it would be after you've gone through your Farrar conference and there's a motion to dismiss, in response to that motion is when you would put forth these proofs that no, defendants contending that the specialty involved is gastroenterology, but we dispute that. And here's our proofs as to why. So as long as there is a genuine dispute as to that, that treatment fell within that specialty, plaintiff should survive, that affidavit should be deemed sufficient. As long as at least one of defendant's stated specialties or subspecialties is, you have an affidavit of merit supporting at least one of them, then you should be able to survive under this framework.
I think I'm hearing two different things, because you were saying that it should be, if they were, I thought you were saying initially that it should be the subject matter of the treatment is multiple specialties, for example.
Well,
if let's say somebody has five, our hypothetical Uber doctor has mm-hmm. has five specialties and only two are potentially relevant. You're not saying that something that was not involved with the treatment at all is enough.
No, I'm saying that under Rule 4:5-3, there's two requirements. One, what is their specialty? And two, whether or not the defendant is contending that that specialty was involved in the care or treatment as pled in the complaint. So in construing that factual issue, plaintiff contends that defendant's wrong, then that issue should be addressed at the Farrar conference. And if there's a motion to dismiss, then plaintiff has the opportunity to put forth proofs that if in construing those proofs in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, that it does establish that at least one specialty or subspecialty has been stated by there is the same, basically, then the plaintiff does survive. Because here you had a defendant who's certifying that he's both. He's not certifying that it's just one. And the defendants have taken the position that not only is it not enough to have both an internist and gastroenterologist, they're saying you need one person with both. And that's a high burden that's not anywhere in the statute. The statute talks about or.
Or two. Not just one person that has both.
Correct. Both specialties.
I wasn't sure actually from their position. Do you understand them to be saying that it could be either one person who's both a gastroenterologist and an internist, or two separate people, one gastroenterologist and one internist?
So I originally thought that they were saying the latter, but in reviewing the brief in response to my amicus brief, it's my understanding that they're arguing for the former, that you need one person who has both the specialty and subspecialty.
Because it's the conceptual lens, and they can't have the same conceptual lens unless they have both in the same human, not just two different humans.
Yes.
So one person who is an internist, a gastroenterologist internist.
Yes. And I believe that is nowhere in the statute. I also think that under Verdicchio, the way that plaintiff is the one who bears the burden to establish the standard of care, then it should be up to the plaintiff to put forth that proof and the expert that they contend where the breach is.
Since gastroenterology is a subspecialty of internal medicine, is every gastroenterologist considered to be an internist?
No, the problem is if you look at Fahnenstein versus Suri, that case actually goes through, doctors don't have to, they at one point would have needed that internal medicine specialty in order to have the sub-board certification, but the doctor doesn't need it to continue their practice. So a lot of times the doctor will give it up. Why? I mean, it's like, lawyers can give up their certification. If they don't need it, they don't keep it. So the problem is you can't make that assumption. That's actually what was the problem in Fahnenstein, is because the doctor had really given up the internal medicine specialty. Had they still had it, then I actually think the case would have been decided differently, because under Nicholas versus Minster, they had the same, they would have had the same specialty. Defendant, I think that we can't let this inequity of defendant declaring what the specialty is lead to dismissal of a meritorious complaint. Defendant can't be permitted to create a straw man to absolve from a breach in one of their practice areas if it's just not a breach in the other. It shouldn't be that defendant can make that declaration, because plaintiff is ultimately the one who has the burden of proof and they bear that burden. So as long as the affidavit is from either a specialist or subspecialist that matches one of defendant's specialties or subspecialties involved in the treatment, then the affidavit should be sufficient.
Still a procedural question about your statement that these issues can be resolved to some degree if the plaintiff has the option of committing to one lane of this road, as it were. I'm going down the gastroenterology road, not the internal medicine road. How would, since the complaint is filed, and there's really no further pleading that's expected from the plaintiff, how would that play itself out? Would that be a letter to the court prior to the Ferrara conference saying we are limiting ourselves to gastroenterology in this
case? It would come out at the Ferrara conference as many of these issues come out. Like in the most recent Gonzalez versus Ibrahim, where they're talking about the common knowledge was discussed at the initial Ferrara conference. And then there's another defendant added later on, and they're declaring that they need an affidavit of merit, but the court had already resolved that issue. It's really fleshed out through that process. And to the extent there is an issue down the road, then we would say that that constitutes exceptional circumstances. So a new defendant is added. So you do need to add a new specialty or something to that extent that you would use that process. And this court has said you get another Ferrara conference so that these new issues can be discussed. So the Ferrara conference really has to be an important part of the medical malpractice case so that we can have these discussions, that we can understand where everyone's coming from and what their positions are. Because ordinarily, these shouldn't be an issue. This should be a discussion that, well, you know, this doesn't actually involve gastroenterology here. And she's being given allopurinol for an acute kidney infection. And when you look at the board for gastroenterology, it has to do with the esophagus, the stomach, the liver, the biliary tract, the pancreas, the small intestine, the colon. That's it. It doesn't have anything to do with the urinary tract. It doesn't have anything to do with a kidney injury. So those issues, and that's what the court had said at that Ferrara conference. So then to go up and have this addition of an and from the appellate division, that's unfair to the plaintiff because they were operating under a certain set of facts. And if you adopt the framework that I'm suggesting, then it would be resolved. That there could be some, and as a NJAJ member, what we really want is this certainty that as long as I have my proof saying that this is not a gastro issue, that this is an internal medicine issue, and I've met the requirements for that, then I should have the ability to say, I'm going to make it through, that I'm not going to be suddenly, the wool's going to be, you know, the rug's going to be pulled out from under me, that I don't have a case anymore in the appellate division.
We're a little bit beyond the 5 minutes.
Sorry, Your Honor.
Hang on one sec. Don't wrap up yet. Anybody have any additional questions? Anything you'd like to add?
The only thing is that there was an allegation that my framework would create a sideshow, but I'm not asking for a mini trial. I'm saying that on that motion to dismiss that defendant's filing anyway, that under rule, as long as proofs competent under rule 166 are presented, we would survive. So thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Tin.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. Dr. Goyal is not a general practitioner. At all times, Dr. Goyal practiced the medical specialties of internal medicine and gastroenterology. Now, I want to be very clear. He did not sometimes put on his internal medicine hat and treat a patient for internal medicine reasons, and other times put on his gastroenterology hat. Rather, he wears both hats. It's not possible for him to segregate the knowledge that he has from internal medicine and GI because they do overlap. Within Dr. Goyal's answer, he was very clear. He practiced the medical specialties of internal medicine and gastroenterology, and the treatment that he rendered in this case involved the medical specialties of not either or, but both internal medicine and gastroenterology. Following the Buck case, it was required that a defendant physician in a malpractice case identify the medical specialty that he or she practices and the treatment. That is exactly what was done in this case. Plaintiff was put on notice that Dr. Goyal's treatment involved the medical specialties of internal medicine and gastroenterology. Instead of taking action, what plaintiff did is they served the affidavit of merit of Stella Fitzgibbons, only board certified in internal medicine. I objected. I had stated that it was not sufficient. Ultimately, the case was in Essex. It was transferred to Union. I mentioned that only because there was a Ferrara conference. As your honors are aware, there is no recording of that Ferrara conference. There was no order from that Ferrara conference. However, the judge at that Ferrara conference, the trial judge, did request a certification from Dr. Goyal. A certification from Dr. Goyal was drafted, indicating, just like he stated in his answer, that his practice at all times was of both internal medicine and gastroenterology. I'll submit to this court that the reason that I asked Dr. Goyal to draft that certification is because it was my understanding that that is the certification that was requested of him. Going on, the same day the court had transferred venue from Essex to Union, I had sent a letter to plaintiff's counsel that was referenced earlier as DA-167. I had referenced that the certification from Dr. Goyal was consistent with my understanding of what was requested at the case at the Ferrara conference. I indicated in the that Dr. Goyal did not have the hospital records. Now, why is that important? Because this issue with the AOM, it comes up early on in the case. I didn't have the hospital records. The attorney for the hospital didn't have Dr. Goyal's records. I don't know what plaintiff's counsel had. Presumably, we would assume that they would have all the records. They would collect them pre-suit, but I don't know. Dr. Goyal doesn't have the recollection to say exactly what was in those hospital records when he served with a complaint. What he has is his office records. What he has is records showing that he rendered care as a gastroenterologist. And what he also has is the knowledge in his head that every patient that he treats as not just internal medicine, but also gastroenterology. It was in that same letter that I advised plaintiff yet again of our position was that he needed a physician board certified in both internal medicine and gastroenterology. Why? An internal medicine physician isn't going to know what someone would know or should know that's board certified in both, just like someone that no longer practices internal medicine and only practices gastroenterology might not have the understanding that someone that practices both has. I want to talk a little bit about the legislative history here and really the intent. Your honors are aware of the intent here. It's to stop these meritless cases. But why did we want to stop the meritless cases? It's because physicians in New Jersey 20 years ago were leaving the state. Even before that, they were leaving the state. Why? Malpractice premiums were too high. So that's why we enacted this kind of law, to weed out those frivolous cases early in the litigation so that our physicians would stay here. There's another part of the Patients First Act statute that isn't often cited, but it's important to cite here. And that's 17:30(d)(22). And that's a provision within the Patients First Act that says if a complaint is dismissed within 180 days of the filing of the physician's answer, the malpractice insurance company cannot increase the rates on that physician. And that goes to show exactly why this was passed in the first place. We had 60 days to file an affidavit of merits, an extension up to 120 days. At that 120-day mark, it is incumbent upon defense counsel if the affidavit of merit is not sufficient, to file an answer, to file a motion to dismiss, rather. Why? Because we don't have much time. We only have until 180 days until the malpractice premiums can start to go up. So we have to file that, and we have to file that quickly.
Counsel, what's the authority for the affidavit of merit? I promise you this is not a trick question.
Sure. The authority for the affidavit of merit is the fact that the legislature has passed the statute requiring an affidavit of merit.
Not the court rule, correct?
Not the court rule. That's correct.
Not principles of tort law.
Correct.
We look to the language of the statute, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
And as a creature of statute, the legislature can require more and it can require less. Let's look at what it says in certain parts of the statute. Section 41, as we've heard, uses the term or, not and. Section 27 speaks to providing each defendant with an affidavit of an appropriate licensed person. Section 29 speaks to a plaintiff failing to provide an affidavit. Is there any spot where the legislature speaks to providing affidavits, providing an affidavit that covers multiple specialties within one? Can you point us to the plain language of the statute that you're relying upon? Because this is a creature of statute.
Sure. And just to clarify my position, I don't think there is a part of the statute that says a plaintiff can or should get multiple affidavits.
Doesn't that hurt you then? Because the legislature can say that. And indeed, in response to any ruling of this court, it could revise the statute to require exactly what you're asking for here. But you've just conceded it doesn't do so in the language of the existing statute.
No, I want to be clear, because I'm not suggesting that a plaintiff has to serve two separate affidavit of merits. I think plaintiff has to serve one affidavit.
One affidavit from someone with both specialties. And I'm asking you where the statute justifies that requirement.
I understand. I think I misunderstood what Your Honor was saying. The statute fundamentally requires that we're getting someone with a kind for kind specialty. You have to have someone that has the same mindset, for lack of a better term.
So I think it would be more helpful, for me at least, if you could point to specific language that tells us the legislature wanted this someone with multiple specialties in a case such as this.
Well, it doesn't use the term multiple specialties. It says the same qualifications. That's the term that's being used. And so if a physician is an MD with no additional qualification, then the same qualification would be just the graduation of medical school. If you're
Where specifically do we see the word qualifications? I see a lot of times the statute talking about whether someone is a specialist or a subspecialist, and the care of treatment involves that specialty or subspecialty. But I think the point that your adversary has been making is that it's all in singular. So if you're saying that there are places where the statute is written in the plural, where would that be?
I'm using the term specialty and subspecialty to be together. But yes, there's nothing in the statute that overtly says if a physician has multiple specialties, you must get an affidavit of merit from both specialties. That's not in the statute. For all practical purposes, that is the intent, because the affidavit of merit was designed so that someone with an equal qualification, and I'm not saying equal tit for tat, that you went to this school, you had to go to that school, but just generally, if you're going to bring a lawsuit against a physician, let's make certain that another qualified physician of generally equal qualifications reviewed that lawsuit, reviewed the basic information to determine if there is or if there is not merit.
So how do you respond to your adversary's point that if there is, let's say, someone who avers that their treatment was both gastroenterology and internal medicine, and you have a statement from an internal medicine practitioner who says that the person deviated from the standard of care of internal medicine, it just doesn't matter if they also deviated from the standard of care in gastroenterology, because they only have to prove one deviation from the standard of care?
Well, First off, you can have a deviation in one field, but not necessarily the other. As an example, it might be
You can.
It might be a deviation, for example, for an internist to perform a colonoscopy. It might not be a deviation for a subspecialist to perform a colonoscopy. So the standard of care is not going to be the same necessarily. It might be a deviation for an internist to prescribe a certain medication, but maybe not a subspecialist. So the standard of care is not always going to be the same. And that's why it's incumbent that the-
I think I'm confused. I thought your adversary was saying if you have two specialties or a specialty and a subspecialty, you have to abide by the standard of care in both. Are you disagreeing with that and saying that there's some lesser standard of care that you have to abide by instead of the standard of care in both?
No, what I'm saying is that the standard of care that applies to a physician that practices internal medicine might not be the same standard of care to someone that's more qualified that practices internal medicine and gastroenterology. That person might be held to a different standard of care because he or she has additional qualifications, additional knowledge.
But might if it's be- only that he or she would be held to additional standards, if they're proving that the person deviated from the internal medicine standard of care, why does it matter? Their point is they only have to prove a deviation from one standard of care. So even if you say, okay, but there's additional standards of care that apply because this person is an internal medicine and gastroenterologist, they're saying, okay, but we are only trying to prove one and that's all we need to win. So how can our lawsuit be thrown out at the threshold as completely frivolous when we only have to prove the deviation of one standard of care and we are planning to do so?
Well, I think you need to look at why Dr. Goyal, internal medicine and gastroenterology, was treating this patient. There's confidential submissions in the appendix. I'm not going to go into that, except to state that he's clearly treating this patient for GI conditions that are chronic in nature. She's not being treated by internal medicine as her primary care physician. Her primary care physician is a GI doctor. If you have HIV, your primary care physician is probably going to be infectious disease. After a certain point in time, if you're diagnosed with a cancer, you might switch your primary care physician to an oncologist. In this case, Dr. Goyal is an is a specialist in internal medicine and also gastroenterology, treating a patient with chronic GI issues. So it's not the standard of care for internal medicine. It's what is the standard of care for a patient that's being treated by a doctor when the treatment concerns GI care.
Sounds like you're saying that the treatment was only for gastroenterology and not for internal medicine. Is that what you're stating?
What I'm saying is that a doctor like Dr. Fitzgibbons that practices only internal medicine would never be treating a patient like this. So she is not the one to put herself in a position to look, is the care appropriate? Rather, and by the way, your honors had asked this question.
Why is that? Because this patient has gastroenterological issues that require the care of a gastroenterologist?
Correct.
So, but why couldn't the physician who provided the AOM be treating her for part of some of her conditions, kidney infection, for example? And somebody else could have been treating her for colonoscopies and other traditional gastroenterology care.
That is certainly possible. That's not the facts of this case. The facts of this case is that Dr. Goyal was serving as both primary care and also GI. That's the facts of this case.
And the plaintiff's argument is that the prescription that was provided in this case was not to treat or care for a for a gastro issue. And the plaintiffs sought the assistance of gastroenterologists, and they have two certifications from gastroenterologists that indicate that certified we cannot provide an AOM here because this treatment with allopurinol would not have been done in the course of treating a gastro issue. So that's the problem we have here. You agree that that's the argument they're making? They sought AOM from a gastroenterologist and they weren't able to obtain one because based on the records that those doctors reviewed, there was no gastro issue being treated with this prescription.
I agree that's their position. First off, I don't know what records they reviewed because the affidavit of merit, because I believe there was only one from Dr. Fitzgibbons, I don't believe identifies what records were reviewed. And although I do suspect that they would have had Dr. Goyal's records and the hospital records and all of the other records, I don't know what they had, what they reviewed, and their expert never actually said what documents were.
Okay,
go ahead. So I don't know what documents were reviewed. With regard to the affidavit of merit, however, at the time when they served the internal medicine affidavit of merit, what they should have done, there was a provision in there. Instead of serving an affidavit of merit from an internal medicine, what by and large happens is when the defense writes the letter, oh, we object, what does the plaintiff do? They get an internal medicine and board certified gastroenterologist. Plaintiff, to my knowledge,
your argument, well, that's your argument of what they should have done. Just so I want to clarify your position. Is it your position? I understand it's your position that one person, an internist gastroenterologist, should have served the AOM. Is that what you believe the appellate division holding says?
Yes, that's part of it. Yes. Part of the holding. Yes.
Okay.
Counsel, you said minutes ago, Dr. Fitzgibbons is not the one to file the affidavit of merit in this case.
Correct.
And I want to ask if you agree with the following addition to that statement. He is not the one to file the affidavit of merit in this case, provided that's what the statute tells us. Would you agree with that?
I think I would have to agree if I understand Your Honor's question that if the statute tells us that it would, and maybe I'm not sure I understand the question, if the statute tells us that it would be multiple people, I'm not sure I understand.
The statute is the source of authority to determine what the appropriate affidavit of merit is. And we need to look to the statute to see what it tells us and how it applies to Dr. Fitzgibbons in this case. So I come back to my earlier question. Tell us what you're relying upon in the statute that answers the question.
Well, again,
the specific words of the statute.
Back to what I said before, I do not believe there is anything overtly in the statute that says that you can have multiple specialties or multiple individuals.
Why isn't that a problem?
Because I think what happens is after time, when you look at the Ferreira case, you look at other cases that have come out, it has been interpreted by this court the same way, looking at that same kind for kind specialty.
Are you saying that this court has previously held that if there's one person with a subspecialty and a specialty or two specialties that you must get an AOM from someone who has those same specialties or subspecialties?
No, the court, to my knowledge, has never addressed that exact question.
And neither has the appellate division, correct? In a published decision.
To my knowledge, that is correct.
And the statute, we're talking about the kind for kind, but the other requirement from the statute is that the care or treatment at issue involves that board specialty or subspecialty. What is the care or treatment at issue in this case? Is it generally Dr. Goyal's statement that it was as an internist and gastroenterologist? Or does the court have to look deeper into what the care or treatment at issue was involved in this case? Because in this case, we have Dr. Goyal stating one thing, and then we have plaintiffs appropriately from their perspective seeking AOMs from gastroenterologists that state this treatment with this prescription is not something that a gastroenterologist would treat. So what is a trial court supposed to do with that?
First off, I'm not certain that plaintiff ever actually sought an AOM from a gastroenterologist, because what Dr. Fitzgibbons writes in essence is it was a deviation to prescribe this medication for reasons. Any GI that was presented with that affidavit of merit would either have to sign that affidavit of merit or not sign that affidavit of merit. What plaintiff submitted was certifications in essence saying that it's not a GI issue. What he did not do was submit.
The estate provided a certification of Dr. Stuart I. Finkel, a gastroenterologist who'd been asked to review the medical records with an eye toward signing an AOM. And Dr. Finkel explained, quote, I could not sign an AOM because I did not have experience in the diagnosis or management of the condition at issue, as there did not appear to be any gastrointestinal issues for me to consider.
Correct. It's not.
You just said they didn't try to get an AOM from any gastro. And he specifically said they did try to get an AOM from him and he was a gastro, but he couldn't provide one because there, quote, did not appear to be any gastrointestinal issues for me to consider.
Let me be clear. The affidavit of merit is written by the attorneys. It's not written, obviously, by the experts. What I'm saying is that there hasn't been anything submitted with the affidavit of merit that plaintiff had shown to the expert is, here's the affidavit of merit I have authored. Can you sign this? Because
when does that ever happen?
I'm sorry.
Lawyers draft things. They don't put it along with a certification. I drafted the certification and then I showed it to him. And, you know, he told me it was either good or not good. I mean, it seems like we're creating all kinds of procedural requirements here that don't have any root in the statute.
You're absolutely correct in exactly what you said. And I think that's kind of my point, and perhaps I'm not explaining it very well. The point is that we don't know what affidavit of merit was drafted by plaintiff's counsel that the expert could not sign because we've never seen it.
Well, what does it matter when we have a certificate, what exact words were drafted in the potential the potential affidavit of merit that was presented to Dr. Finkel? Dr. Finkel specifically says they could not sign it because there do not appear to be any gastrointestinal issues for me to consider.
And there was a second one by Dr. Eisner, who is also a gastroenterologist, saying he was asked to review the matter to see if the defendant gastroenterologist was negligent, and said, familiar with prescribing allopurinol, and I'm aware of no known gastrointestinal conditions that is treated by that drug.
And the next step he could have, if it was actually an affidavit of merit as opposed to a certification, it could have been an affidavit of merit, and therefore there exists a reasonable likely probability that you should and use all the magic language for an affidavit, and that could have been the affidavit of merit.
But even if it was the affidavit of merit that they received from that plaintiff received from Dr. Finkel, your position is that's not enough anyway, right?
Quite frankly, that's my position today, and I will tell you at trial. I'm not certain that at the trial court level, I'm not certain that that would have been my position. Even if it was, we would not be here today.
I'd just like to follow up on a line of questioning from Justice Pierre-Louis to understand the contours of your argument. Let's say in this case, Dr. Goyle also had a certification in psychiatry. And Dr. Goyle says, of course, I need to take into consideration the mental health and well-being of all of my patients. So psychiatry comes into play in everything I do. And the affidavit of merit came in from an internist and a gastroenterologist questioning the prescription of allopurinol, in this case, for kidney stones. Are you saying that that would not be sufficient? And not only would plaintiffs have had to have an affidavit of merit from an internist and a gastroenterologist, they'd also have to have a psychiatrist because Dr. Goyle was a psychiatrist because he, quote unquote, my quotes, takes into consideration the mental health and well-being of all his patients?
I think the way that it's under Buck, if that was what was in Dr. Goyal's answer, if Dr. Goyal's answer certified that I practiced internal medicine, gastroenterology, and psychiatry, and at all times my treatment of this patient was of internal medicine, gastroenterology, and psychiatry, then yes, plaintiff would need to get affidavit merit from someone that's board certified in all three. Now,
person who's board certified in all three.
And that would be, I think, probably impossible because I don't think you can actually go through the pathways to become to psychiatry and the pathways to become to GI would take a god-awful long time. I'm not sure that you would get there. But either way, if that happened, what you would then do is you would file for a waiver. That would be the exact time if I had filed a motion to dismiss because only an AOM was served from an internal medicine physician. I would expect the plaintiff in that situation to file for a waiver, a cross motion or something like that.
But a waiver is necessary when you can't comply with the statute for some reason or another. The question that begs the question we have before us, and that is, what does the statute require? Right? So if plaintiff goes for a waiver, that's on a situation where they've they missed the deadline or there's a violation of statutory requirements that they want to have a waiver for.
Well, no, I was responding to a question where if there was a physician with three specialties and the attorney, the plaintiff, could not get an affidavit of merit because he or she could not find someone qualified in those three specialties, you could then request a waiver of that.
You would need a waiver if the statute requires that the same human being have the exact same three or four or five specialties as the doctor who's the defendant, right?
Correct, yes.
So we're back to our original question, which is where in the statute does it require the same person to show up with the exact same constellation of qualifications as the defendant?
And as I have stated before, and if I had missed it, I'm sure I'll be corrected, but I do not believe that overt language is in the statute.
And then don't you just run into the problem of singular versus plural again? Because again, the waiver provision only talks about the court may waive the same specialty or subspecialty recognized by blah, 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 upon motion by the party seeking a waiver, if after the moving party has demonstrated to the satisfaction of the court that a good faith effort has been made to identify an expert in the same specialty or subspecialty. It doesn't say an expert in the same specialties or subspecialties. So if the legislature had wanted one person to have to submit across many specialties or subspecialties, they could have written that. This cannot be the only doctor in New Jersey who has more than one specialty or a specialty plus a subspecialty. The legislature had to have been aware that that exists, and yet they used the singular and not the plural.
That is true. All I can tell you is what has happened over the course of the last, say, since Buck, really. And since Buck, every answer that gets filed that I have seen when the case is about someone involving GI and internal medicine, it identifies both. And maybe the reason is this. When a plaintiff files a complaint and asserts claims of negligence, they assert claims of negligence. And a year down the road, 2 years down the road, plaintiff might serve an expert report. And that expert report is limited to claims of negligence. And it's not claims of negligence that are stated in the complaint. It's just medical malpractice. And oftentimes you'll get served with an expert report that lists 35 deviations. And you're scratching your head. How are these deviations? How are they anywhere in the complaint? And you file a motion, or at least
isn't that true across the board in tort claims?
Absolutely.
Across the board, that there's general language.
Absolutely.
That provides the framework, but doesn't, especially pre-discovery, is not going to say the following deviations from the standard of care took place and have a litany of those, because that's what discovery is all about. Maybe there turns out to be nothing. Maybe there turns out to be two. Maybe there turns out to be 10 that are alleged when those deviations, but you got to wait until a later stage of the litigation to get that disclosure.
That's exactly right. And if we allow an affidavit of merit from an internal medicine physician on the premise that it's about this one little thing, that there is nothing stopping that plaintiff a year down the road, 2 years down the road,
mending the complaint and adding to it. Yeah,
exactly.
But then don't you deal with that before your judge and say, we have a new case here.
Mm-hmm.
We have a new case none of this was in the original complaint. They had the medical records, and there should be an affidavit of merit supporting this new claim.
Absolutely. And routinely, when that kind of motion is filed, the trial judge say, well, the complaint only has to allege malpractice, doesn't have to say specifically what the deviations are. So you're allowed to expand that. So even if an affidavit of merit is served from only an internal medicine physician, there is nothing stopping that same plaintiff a year down the road, 2 years later, from identifying GI deviations. From now saying, you know what? Maybe it was a bad idea that I got an internal medicine expert.
Tell me what the practice is. Do defense counsel in those situations where something starts out very simple and circumscribed and easy to understand and turns into a longer period of time, all different areas of treatment that went, the case expands in an amended complaint, which I think is the situation you're talking about. Do you go back as a defense lawyer and say to the judge, this is a different case now? And there should be the affidavit of merit should be a new affidavit of merit that covers a very different case than we thought we were dealing with at the beginning of this case.
Well, first off, it doesn't happen just when there's an amended complaint, because the plaintiff doesn't have to amend the complaint. The plaintiff has already advanced allegations of malpractice, and the plaintiff doesn't have to say what that malpractice is.
Right, but so, I thought you were talking about a new claim and expand a claim and a complaint.
A new claim in the sense that plaintiff only has the obligation to advance a claim of malpractice, and I don't know what that malpractice necessarily is in this case.
Isn't that why you serve interrogatories?
Correct, but we didn't in this case. We right. don't before the AT, before the AOM, it doesn't typically happen. This is an AOM. We didn't have answers to interrogatories, which is why I don't have the hospital records. It's why the hospital doesn't have Dr. Goyal's records. We don't have plaintiff's answers to interrogatories or anything in this case because none of that stuff happened. This is at the AOM, that threshold early stage.
Counselor, where, if at all, in the records does Dr. Goyal tie the treatment of kidney stones with allopurinol to colonoscopy, esophagogastroduodenoscopy, rectal bleeding, or black stools? Where are those tied?
The records that we have here are not the full records. As I had said, the records were not exchanged during discovery. Part of the reason that I have to assume that part of the reason that Buck said that the defendant knows the practice of which he practices is because Dr. Goyal has his records and nothing else. He doesn't know what happened at the hospital. He doesn't know how they're related. No defendant physician would, unless they're directly employed by the hospital, which most are not, because they don't have access to those records. So what he has are his records, and his records are not the same as the hospital records. So he doesn't know what happened at the hospital.
And I'm talking about his cert. His cert says that I discussed those four things with Ms. Carter. So where, if at all, anywhere, is the treatment of kidney stones with allopurinol tied to the gastroenterological conditions that he said he previously has treated Ms. Carter?
At the stage of the litigation that we are even presently at, we just don't know. He wasn't deposed. Answers to interrogatories weren't yet served. So we don't even have the full record. So I just can't answer that question. I'm not sure that anyone could.
So then how could a court throw out the case and say at this, you keep saying this is a very threshold stage and this is right at the beginning of the case. But their point is the motion to dismiss was granted with prejudice. So now the case is just over, even though at the very beginning they had a certification from someone who said, I'm an internal medicine practitioner, and the prescription of allopurinol in this instance deviated the standard of care. Why is that okay?
Because it deviated from the standard of care of someone that practices internal medicine, and she can only testify and she can only ever opine and give that opinion as to someone that practices internal medicine, and Dr. Goyal does not. Dr. Goyal practices pursuant to his answer, which was required by Buck, pursuant to his certification. Dr. Goyal practices, he doesn't wear one hat, he simultaneously wears two because he practices internal medicine and gastroenterology. So the only person that is qualified to criticize Dr. Goyal is another person that practices internal medicine.
Even when he's treating a kidney condition, he's practicing gastroenterology?
Even when he's treating his primary care patient that he is treating as a gastroenterologist for a constellation of problems. Yes, I am not a medical doctor. And with all due respect, no one in this room, to my knowledge, is. I don't know how that all interconnects medically. Perhaps if we ask Dr. Goyal, he could explain that to us. Perhaps if we ask Dr. Solny, he would be able to explain it to us. I have to believe that's why the Buck court said that the defendant physician knows the practice of which the specialty of which he or she practices, because Dr. Goyal does know that. He knows he's board certified in internal medicine and gastroenterology, and it would not have been an onerous proposition to either get an affidavit of merit from someone that was board certified in both internal medicine and gastroenterology, or conversely request the waiver.
But you just told me that you know nothing, can point to anything that ties the prescription of allopurinol for kidney stones to the four gastroenterological conditions that he discusses in his certification. Therefore, you've just told me that he's not wearing both hats. You have nothing to indicate that he actually has both hats on at the same time.
No, Your Honor, what I'm saying is that I don't know because I'm not internal medicine and I'm not gastroenterology, and that discovery did not happen in this case. What I'm telling you is that the person that is most qualified, Dr. Goyal, the most qualified person to tell us what he did, how he practiced, what he was doing, he told us. And mind you, this was before an affidavit of merit was served. It's not like an affidavit of merit was served from internal medicine and we turned around and said, ha ha, we got you. We're not internal medicine. No. We put it in our answer before the affidavit of merit, and plaintiff ignored what was put in the answer.
Counsel, is there anything else you'd like to touch upon?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
Any other questions, anyone? Thank you. Ms. Cutnell, I know your claim is one of vicarious liability and that you've asked for 30 minutes. So we welcome your abbreviating your argument in light of what we've already heard.
Of course. May it please the court, and I hope to address some of the questions that the court has asked in a different light and with some additional logical connection in real practice, as well as an evaluation of the statute itself, the legislative history, and the analysis of the statute through the various cases that this court has decided before. And so I think we have to start with Proposition 1, which is, yes, the defense's position is that a similarly credentialed physician must sign an affidavit of merit against a defense doctor. And that is pursuant to the language of the Patients First Act, which was born out of a time period when we had skyrocketing insurance premiums, doctors unable to be insured, doctors leaving the state, and there needed to be reform. And that reform was is that we would put in the kind for kind, same specialty equivalency requirements. And so here, because Dr. Goyal, number one, is plaintiff put in their own complaint, specialized in both internal medicine and gastroenterology. That's in plaintiff's complaint. Dr. Goyal, in his answer, said it was both, and the treatment involved both. Then he signed a certification saying that. His CV supported that. Then he obtained a certification from an expert on his own behalf, Dr. Solny. And Dr. Solny, and this is at DA 232 to 234, also, like Dr. Goyal, those two are the only two physicians in this case that specialize in internal med and gastroenterology. None of the experts proffered by plaintiff have those same specialties. Dr. Fitzgibbons is board certified and specializes only in internal medicine. So her comments on what or what is not contemplated or is appropriate in gastroenterology, she cannot bring to the table because she does not have that background training and expertise above and beyond internal medicine. The other experts relied upon by plaintiff, two of whom submitted certifications, only, and in their certifications say, only specialize in gastroenterology. There's not one expert that plaintiff sought out, attempted to retain, have them sign a certification that has the same background, credentials, experience, and knowledge as Dr. Goyal. Because they don't have the same expertise, they cannot establish the appropriate standard of care, and therefore the case has no merit, and we don't meet the threshold requirement, just like the conclusion of this court when analyzing Nicholas v. Minster. There they concluded, yes, there was an affidavit of merit signed by a physician. There was an expert report, in fact. But the physician who signed the affidavit of merit and wrote the expert report did not have the same credentials as the defense doctor. So therefore, there was no merit. Because if you don't bring in the right expertise, you don't establish the appropriate standard, and therefore you don't have merit. And I think that we need to start by looking at it this way. If Dr. Goyal's answer had stated that he specialized in gastroenterology only, and the care and treatment involved only that specialty, there would be no plausible argument that could be made before this or any other court that an internal medicine doctor meets the kind for kind specialty requirement. And that's because there is a specialty of internal medicine, and then there's a subspecialty of gastroenterology, which requires additional training, experience, knowledge, fellowship training, and then you have to sit for the board certification, and then you have additional continuing education requirements required. And then every 7 years, you have to recertify and prove your continuing education credits. So Dr. Goyal brings that training and experience to his care of the plaintiff, and she sought him out because he had those specialties. She didn't seek out a physician to treat her who was only internal medicine. She sought out a physician who specialized in internal medicine and gastroenterology. So if she wishes to sue him, in order to prove that her case has merit, she needs to have an expert who has the same specialties. So if gastroenterology was the only specialty and plaintiff only got an internal med, everyone would agree that that would not be sufficient. It's not kind for kind. If the doctor's specialties are both internal medicine and gastroenterology, then one or the other cannot suffice. And that's not, that includes,
but this look at Nicholas of Rehminster, which was only, well, it's been a decade, I shouldn't say it was recent, but that involved a situation where that neither of the two specialties was shared by the physician who signed the AOM.
That's correct.
So that this is different.
It is different, but I think Nicholas V. Minster guides us in certain regards, but I think we need to start with, and the questions posed earlier about, let's start with the plain language of the statute. And then I think Nicholas V. Minster assists us because it does go through the legislative history, which I think casts additional light. But if we start with the plain language, when we are interpreting a statute.
Starting with the plain language of the statute, you consistently just now referred to how you need someone with the same specialties, yet the statute only uses the singular. It only talks about a specialty or a subspecialty. So where do we understand from the statute that you need someone who has the same specialties, even though it leaves off the IES and only has a Y?
I appreciate that. But when interpreting statutes, our case law guides us that we have to presume that every word in a statute has meaning and is not mere surplusage. And we have to give those words effects and not render them a nullity. And so indeed, every word has to be given effect. None can be ignored. And none should needlessly be given an interpretation that causes it to have no consequence.
So tell us specifically which language in the statute you're relying upon for the answer to this multi-specialty question in front of the court.
So if the court were to follow the...
Which specific language in the statute is my question, are you relying upon?
Specialty or subspecialty. If the court were to rely on the dicta in Buck that says, if a doctor practices in multiple specialties and they overlap, then either would suffice, then one of those words in the statute would be deemed a nullity, would be surplusage, and would have no consequence, no meaning, and would be irrelevant.
Sorry,
and
I mean, why would that be deemed surplusage? So there's been prior cases where there's someone who is only an internal medicine practitioner and there's someone else who's only a gastroenterologist. And even though gastroenterology is a subspecialty of internal medicine, courts have held does not suffice because the statute specifically says that the expert has to have the same specialty or subspecialty. The issue here is that the expert does have the same specialty. The specialty of both of the experts is internal medicine. One of them also has a subspecialty of gastroenterology, but they both have the same specialty, and that is internal medicine. So I'm not understanding how would that be ignoring the words of the statute rather than just giving them effect that they're written in singular instead of plural.
Because when you read the statute that way and only affect the specialty and not the subspecialty, by saying this doctor has two specialties and plaintiff only has one, you're ignoring the subspecialty part of the statute and you're rendering it meaningless. Meaning,
you're not rendering it meaningless because in a different case where a doctor only has a subspecialty and then a different doctor who doesn't have that subspecialty and only has a specialty, then the AOM requirement is not met by providing either way. Like you can't provide an AOM from someone who only has a subspecialty against someone who only has a specialty and vice versa.
But in this case and other cases where a physician has more than one, either more than one specialty or more than one subspecialty or a specialty and a subspecialty, if you read it as either or could suffice, then you're rendering part of the statute meaningless, a nullity, and surplusage, and you're not giving meaning to that word because here, what plaintiff is proposing is you can ignore the subspecialty.
So imagine,
even though the doctor,
please finish.
Even though the doctor brings not only the expertise of internal medicine, but the expertise of gastroenterology to his care of the patient. And so therefore taking that interpretation of the language of the statute would render part of the statute surplusage language meaningless. And in certain cases, I can see that it would not, but in this, imagine, it would in others.
Imagine if the statute instead said specialty, comma, subspecialty, comma, or multiple specialties or subspecialties. Would any part of that be surplusage if it were interpreted in the way that you're interpreting the statute today? Would
no,
you say
because
we've ignored some of the language?
No, because by virtue of the fact that the added language would then require both of those before it to be considered, nothing would be surplusage because it would be subsumed in the third option.
Right, but that's the issue. Why is it subsumed in the first two or somehow surplusage if it's not, where it lacks that specific language?
Well, I think that number one, because if you were to interpret as we have in this case, part of it would be completely ignored. And I think it doesn't just apply to gastroenterology, but if you think about this practically, when we look at the Board of Internal Medicine, there's many different subspecialties. They include cardiology, they include infectious disease, they include interventional cardiology, nephrology, pulmonologists. These are all specialists that individuals seek out for treatment at various points in time. And some doctors may specialize in both internal medicine and cardiology per se, or internal medicine and infectious disease, or some might only be infectious disease or cardiology. Sure, the analysis is much simpler when it's only the subspecialty and not the specialty and the subspecialty, but we need to view the statute in light of this interplay of these additional training experience and knowledge. Because if you have a patient that goes to a doctor for cardiology care and internal medicine care, then you can't have a doctor opining. What plaintiff is proposing is that anytime you have someone who has a specialty and a subspecialty, even though the patient seeks out that doctor for that treatment, is receiving treatment for both of those specialties, it would suffice for them to only get an internal medicine doctor. So now you're going to have cardiologists across the state that specialize in both who are going to have an expert against them that only has expertise in internal medicine. And therefore, they're going to establish an inappropriate standard of care as to that doctor who has experience, knowledge, and training that far exceeds that of internal medicine. And you're going to subject them to an inappropriate standard of care.
So you would have, let's say somebody had a cardiac procedure, and then you have an internist who has no experience in doing those cardiac procedures, doing the AOM, but that would seem to me to be dealt with if we were to require relevance of the specialty generally to the treatment that was given.
I don't think so, because I think just as in here, what the plaintiff could argue is, well, internal medicine and cardiology have overlap. And so it's my position that this involves only internal medicine, and therefore I don't need to get someone who has a specialty of cardiology. And now you have a cardiologist
at a Ferrara conference who was dealing with something that that arose out of a cardiac procedure that only a cardiologist can do, and somebody walks in as an internist with no cardiology experience other than back in their residency days, wouldn't a judge in a Ferrara conference recognize that that's not directly relevant to the treatment?
No, because I think the argument can be made, as it's been made here, that this doctor specializes in two specialties. Plaintiff's expert is only clearly one. He stated it involves both, and they're saying that either would suffice. And
no, so I think that you're, I think this case is significantly narrower than you seem to be currently implying, in that they have two certifications from gastroenterologists saying they could not find any practice of gastroenterology anywhere in the medical records here. Presumably, if it is a cardiac procedure, you could not possibly get two certifications from two cardiologists saying we can't see anything about the practice of cardiology here.
I think it's an even finer point than that, because when you're talking about someone who specializes in internal med and cardiology, there are certain medications that are used to treat cardiac conditions that internal medicine physicians will prescribe all the time. But a cardiologist has additional training experience and knowledge as to what's appropriate or not. They might think that under their standard of care of cardiology, because they have additional training experience and knowledge, that a certain medication wouldn't be appropriate, that an internal medicine doctor would think it would be, but the internal medicine doctor wouldn't know that that was inappropriate because they don't have that additional training experience and knowledge, such as here.
But here where you have all these certifications from gastroenterologists. So in your example, that's a cardiologist, right? You're giving an example of an internal medicine and cardiology together. And in the record here, it's internal medicine plus gastroenterology together, correct?
Yes.
So here we have certifications from two gastroenterologists saying, quote, there was no known gastrointestinal condition treated by allopurinol from one of them. And then, quote, I could not sign an affidavit of merit because I do not have experience in the diagnosis or management of the condition at issue as there did not appear to be any gastrointestinal issues for me to consider. So it seems like you're saying that the plaintiffs are trying to make an argument that they're not trying to make. They're pointing to the fact that they tried to get something from a gastroenterologist, but gastroenterologists kept saying, we can't provide anything because there was no practice of gastroenterology here for us to review. And we did review the medical records.
Well, therein lies the problem. They did not ever, and there's no evidence in this record that they ever sought out an expert who had the same specialties as the defendant, internal medicine and gastroenterology. Those gastroenterologists in their certification state they only specialize in gastroenterology, not internal medicine, gastroenterology. Dr. Fitzgibbons, only specialize in internal medicine. So I, like Dr. Fitzgibbons, don't have expertise in gastroenterology. I can't explain.
But they found those experts who just focus on gastroenterology. So they had that additional expertise and reviewed the case and said that, are you suggesting that only somebody who had that additional experience in gastroenterology, but also the internal medicine could make these conclusions and prescribe this medication?
Only. No, that's a different issue than that's before the court. The issue is whether or not the affiant who signed the affidavit of merit is qualified to do it as against Dr. Goyal. If it was another doctor with different training experience and knowledge, what the standard of care would require of them based on those facts and the treatments of that patient would be judged by what their qualifications were. And so here, plaintiff has never shown proof from an expert who has the same qualifications as the defendant to establish an appropriate standard of care against him. And like I was saying, I also am not a gastroenterologist, but I mean, a review of medical literature shows that there are many uses for allopurinol, which in fact, the only evidence in this case that shows that is Dr. Solny. He's the only non-defendant expert in this case who says, I specialize in both specialties. There are uses in gastroenterology for allopurinol. It can be used in accordance with the standard of care. I can't separate out my knowledge, experience, and training as both in treating a patient, and the care and treatment from Dr. Goyal involved both. And I think that's important because the medical literature supports that allopurinol can be used for inflammatory bowel. That's,
right, but what was it used? But Dr. Solny certifies that it could be used for a variety of issues. But we're talking about the issue in this case specifically.
He said specifically allopurinol.
Specifically allopurinol, but what about the specific condition that the allopurinol was prescribed for? The high uric acid, the kidney issue.
Well, I think that's getting very granular into something that goes well beyond a showing of an initial threshold of proof. And what this court has required.
I think it's in the question of the care and treatment at issue in this case. What was the care and at the care or treatment at issue in this case? That's the question. And who gets to answer that? Does a judge with two certifications from two gastroenterologists that the plaintiff sought out for affidavits of merit advising in their certification that there was no gastrointestinal issue that they could identify so they couldn't sign an affidavit of merit? Or is it what Dr. Goyal states in his certification? Is that gospel, like counsel for NJAJ said? Whatever the physician in their certification states, that's gospel.
So I think, first of all, that this court has set forth a requirement that defendant doctors put that in their answer. And this case comes after that requirement in Buck. And the defendant complied with it. So I don't think, and I think as this court has stated in Buck, and as the appellate division explained in Fannestein, the doctor certification as to their specialties should not be disregarded. And here, if plaintiff had focused any efforts on getting a doctor who specialized in the same two specialties as the defendant, we would not be here today. Instead, their efforts were focused on trying to create an exception to what the care and treatment involved and getting experts who did not have the appropriate qualifications to sign an affidavit of merit. And so perhaps that belies the question, perhaps there is no merit because someone who has the appropriate qualifications did not sign an affidavit of merit and could not be found. And there was no waiver motion made. And
I think, how far does this extend? Consider Justice Hoffman's example of the psychiatrist who perhaps went into psychiatry later after becoming board certified in three subspecialties of internal medicine. So that you've got four areas of expertise. You got to have for your AOM, which deals with a miss on a colonoscopy. You also have to have somebody who's board certified in psychiatry.
So I've not been doing medical malpractice as long as others.
But never seen such a person.
I've never seen such a person in my 14 years of experience. I doubt it would ever happen because the two boards are completely distinct from each other. But if that were truly the case, that's why we have the waiver provision. And so therefore, it probably would be very hard to find one expert who has all those specialties. And that's why the legislature provided for a waiver. So that if you can't find the appropriately qualified physician, not that there's no merit to your case, but if that type of specialty doesn't exist, we have a waiver. And I think that I had started on this point and I got very far afield, but I think there's one very important issue that needs to be addressed, which is I had started by saying this is addressed by this plainly the statute and the case law in Nicholas v. Minster. And when we look at Nicholas v. Minster, which was written by retired Justice Albin, writing for a unanimous court. And Justice Alvin certainly sided on the side of the plaintiff, of the patient, many times. He advocated for patients' rights and patients.
Let's go right to the opinion.
And so if we look at that, there are a number of parts of the opinion. And when we look at the legislative history, which Justice Alvin very clearly relayed in that opinion, it shows that that's the purpose of this statute, that the legislature intended was to have same practice, same credentials, kind for kind, be reflected. And so here on page 468.
Nicholas and I think the chief and I are probably the only members of the court currently on the court who are involved with this, but Nicholas involved a miss on the part of the plaintiff as to both targets, both areas of practice, family and emergency were the two.
And
shows up with an affidavit of merit by somebody who has some expertise in the hyperbaric. But who just doesn't have either of the two qualifications that the defendant physician had.
Sure. And I appreciate it. Yes. Plaintiff's one expert was internal medicine with subspecialties in pulmonary disease, critical care, and then a board certification preventative medicine with subspecialty in undersea and hyperbaric medicine. And then the other doctor was only internal medicine. The defendants were emergency medicine. And then the other defendant was family medicine. And it was argued that there was overlap between internal medicine and family medicine. They treat the same maladies.
But you had two specialties in those cases, not subspecialties, but two specialties that are relevant to the defendants. And you had an AOM, which had by somebody or by people who lacked either one. That's a different scenario than this one.
Right. But in reaching that conclusion, the court went through a very thorough review of the statute and the legislative history that led it to come to that conclusion.
Did it repudiate the language in Bach that has been quoted in Nicholas versus Minster?
Yeah, so there's two issues with that. So first, when we look at the Bach language, the dicta that was relied upon by plaintiff and which the appellate division said was not appropriate, I think there's two reasons. One,
I know the appellate division said that, but under State versus Rose, it's a principled statement of law by the high court, and it's to be treated as such, not as dicta. Do you take a different view?
The view I take is as follows.
View of dicta?
No, I do not take a different view of dicta.
So that's the law until this court says otherwise. No?
So I think there's two issues with that. One, in Buck, the court was not analyzing specialty for specialty. It was whether it was a general practitioner versus a subspecialist. So they weren't actually addressing that issue. And two, when you look at the portion where that either specialty would be sufficient, there's actually a footnote to that, footnote eight. And it says a physician board certified in a specialty can offer an affidavit in a case involving a physician not board certified in that specialty. But under the equivalency doctrine, the reverse is not permitted, and it cites to the PFA. However, under the plain language of the PFA, that's not accurate. The PFA actually does allow someone who's not board certified to give an opinion against someone who is board certified.
I may be misreading this, but doesn't the footnote apply to the prior sentence and not the one that has been quoted for us?
My point being, though, that this entire paragraph where this discussion is being had about specialties and whether either will suffice, it's citing to part of the Patients First Act with regard to board certifications, and it's in the context of this equivalency doctrine. However, board certification, a doctor who does not have a board certification can, under the PFA, actually provide an opinion against someone who does have a board certification, as long as they, number one, specialize in the same specialty as the defendant. Number two, they would then have to go under, if it's a board certification, they would have to meet the hospital credentialing requirement. So they could give the opinion without being board certified. That's permitted. And so when you look at it in the context of that, in the context of the case of a whole, and the fact that it wasn't specialty for specialty, you reach that conclusion. But if we go to Nicholas v. Minster, there, the court at page 468, when talking about the case, said, under a plain textual reading of the act, plaintiffs cannot establish a standard of care through an expert who does not practice in the same medical specialties as defendant physicians. And then most importantly, at pages 444 to 46.
But that's a reference to entirely different specialties, not what Buck versus Henry in those two sentences is speaking about. Am I mistaken?
That's the layout, but then the more
poignant and specific issue is, that conclusion doesn't follow from a textual reading. And then it goes on to say, it certainly is not consistent with the sponsor's statement to the bill that later became NJSA 2A:53A-41, which reads, quote, an expert must have the same type of practice and possess the same credentials as applicable as the defendant healthcare provider unless waived by the court. That's the Assembly Health and Human Services Committee statement to Assembly Bill number 50 at 20, March 4, 2024. And then the court goes on to say plaintiff's approach would render the same specialty requirement meaningless. And it goes on to take the logic of plaintiff's argument, where there they were saying if you're credentialed by a hospital to treat a condition, that would mean that you're it's appropriate even if you're in different specialties. I think that same logic applies here. If it's not the same specialty, then you're not appropriately qualified. And it would lead back to the days before the passage of the Patients First Act, where in medical malpractice cases, physician experts of different medical specialties, but who treated similar maladies could offer testimony, even though not equivalently credentialed to defendant physicians.
But this case is somewhere in the middle between Nicholas on the one hand and the case where there is a exact match, right? This is in the middle between those two situations. Nicholas doesn't deal with this scenario. This is
the application of Nicholas does not deal with this scenario. I agree. But I think that the legislative history, the sponsor statement to the bill that the expert has to have the same type of practice and possess the same credentials gives further context to the specialty or subspecialty in the statute itself. And when interpreting it in the context of that history, it is clear that they wanted them to have the same specialty. And then in Nicholas v. Minster, the court goes on to cite to additional history. And this is on page 45 at footnote 16. The issue of whether an expert physician in one specialty should be able to testify against a physician in a different specialty was squarely before the Assembly Health and Human Services Committee. And they referenced the testimony of Dr. Clifford W. Tolliver, who is an OBGYN expert practicing in East Orange. And he explained to the committee his issues with being uninsurable because he practiced in a high risk area of East Orange where he served an underserved community. And he was unable to become insured because of the high risk of OB. And in fact, OBGYN claims are some of the highest value claims. They have some of the highest risks. They're some of the physicians who are the hardest to have obtain insurance. They have very high insurance premiums. The board of OBGYN, obstetrics and gynecology, has a subspecialty of maternal and fetal medicine. And so this is another example. You can both OBGYNs and MFMs review ultrasounds for patients. But if you're a high-risk pregnancy, your OBGYN will refer you to a maternal and fetal medicine specialist. There can be maternal fetal medicine specialists who practice in both OB and in MFM. And so if they're reviewing an ultrasound that could plausibly be done by an OB, but they're reviewing it with their training experience and knowledge as an MFM, it would be inappropriate and contrary to the intent of the statute, the legislative history, and a practical application of it to have an expert judge them who does not have the same qualifications, because now you have someone without the appropriate expertise come to the table to subject them to a standard of care that is not the standard of care applicable to them based on their training experience and expertise. And it would be impossible to separate out the two.
What if the treatment dealt with an area that an OBGYN specialist would cover, and I can't think of what that might be, and it's a waste of time to try, but which is not something limited to maternal and fetal medicine doctors. See what I'm saying? Which is here, you have a treatment that crossed over time, but the precise allegation here arises out of a prescription that we are told was related to the kidneys, not to any gastroenterological care.
Well, now I think we're going down a path where this court wanted to avoid, which is that the affidavit of merit statute is to make sure that there's merit to claims. The only way to ensure that is making sure that the appropriately qualified, trained, and credentialed individuals provide opinions against the same type of credentialed individual as the legislature intended. And so if you can't separate out the experience of a maternal fetal medicine specialist who does a fellowship, who then has to submit case training, who has to sit for an additional board, has to attend additional continuing education credits from that
of an OBGYN. And so,
but what if the, what if, I'll try an example. It may not be right. What if the alleged malpractice is in not providing the results of a pap smear to a non-pregnant patient, something like that, which has nothing to do with maternal and fetal specialty, which has nothing to do with obstetrics, but is within the, the area of expertise of an OBGYN who practices both obstetrics and gynecology. Is it really going to be insufficient for an OBGYN to give an opinion on whether that constitutes malpractice?
So one, if it truly didn't involve obstetrics and MFM, then I presume that the doctor would not certify in their answer that the care and treatment involved that subspecialty if it did not.
But the doctor said that the whole history of the patient's care had involved prior pregnancies and prior deliveries, and it was all connected, sort of like this case, which covers the entire universe of treatment, then wouldn't it be similar to this case?
Well, I think therein lies the problem. These are very complex issues that require the complex analysis of the appropriately credentialed expert, which I do not possess. And I don't know the interplay, how prior pregnancies could impact on a pap smear, if perhaps it could raise your risk for certain conditions that an MFM would know about, certain genetic conditions, certain cancers, certain other medical conditions that an MFM would have additional training, experience, and knowledge on that an OBGYN would not. And I think that's why we shouldn't start carving out exceptions to specialists and allowing someone who doesn't have the appropriate credentials to opine as to a physician. And I think this goes both ways. Not only should someone who doesn't have the extra credentials opine against a physician who does, someone who has a superior training experience and knowledge should not opine against someone who has lesser, because in either instance, they will be subjecting them to a standard of care that physician is not held to and should not be held to by virtue of their training experience and knowledge. And that's why we have kind for kind equivalency.
So the legislature has required plaintiffs to find the exact, you know, twin separated at birth doctors who have exactly the same combination of specialties, and otherwise their case fails?
No, that's why we have a waiver. It's particularly for that instance where it is a very rare or lesser found specialty, or doctor who's a super doctor who has two specialties or three specialties.
Again,
that's
the waiver language doesn't actually say anything about that, right? It just says, upon motion by the party seeking a waiver, if after the moving party has demonstrated to the satisfaction of the court that a good faith effort has been made, try to identify an expert in the same specialty or subspecialties. Did you say anything about multiple subspecialties? It just uses the same singular as the rest of the statute, which makes it seem like as long as you have someone who has the same specialty or the same subspecialty, because there's an or and not an and, you are all good.
Will you answer that question? Are there other questions anyone has? And if you could draw your argument to a close, we're beyond a half hour now with your response to this.
Understood. Thank you. So, The waiver language itself speaks about the specialty or subspecialty and board certification requirements of the section, and it can be waived after a motion is filed if the moving party has demonstrated the satisfaction of the court that good faith effort has been made to identify an expert in the same specialty or subspecialty, and that the expert possesses sufficient training, experience, or knowledge. And when you look at the case law interpreting that, the factors that are to be considered are the number of experts in the field, how many are in this area, how many in that subspecialty are in this area. And what it's contemplating is that in the case of a specialty that's not as common, or a physician that holds multiple specialties, that if you cannot find that type of expert, that you can apply for a waiver. And I think the issue that we have here and where the rubber meets the road is that there was never an attempt or any evidence submitted to this court to obtain an expert who had the same two specialties as the defendant. And so without that attempt, without that type of expertise being brought to the table, there can be no showing of merit at the first instance, no threshold. And I appreciate that this case might have a finer application than other cases, but I think we need to look at the big picture as well, because what's being suggested is that routinely any physician who sought out for treatment, including in multiple specialty areas, could be subjected to a standard of care from an expert who doesn't hold those same expertise. And that would underdo the entire purpose of the Affidavit of Merit statute, the Patients First Act, which was to reduce
malpractice claims, which was to make sure only meritorious claims proceed so that we didn't have this out of control skyrocketing costs of malpractice insurance, which therefore led to physicians leaving the state and restricted patient care to specialists and subspecialists, which are needed throughout the state. And so I think the only way to enact the purposes of the legislature, as they succinctly stated it in their own language, as cited by this court, Nicholas v. Mincer, is to make sure that it's kind for kind, specialty for specialty, equivalency requirement, whichever way the court wants to use the language. And that's the only way to ensure that only merit cases with merit proceed and that physicians are subjected to the appropriate standard of care.
Thank you, counsel. John, brief rebuttal.
Please, the court. Briefly, Your Honor. So Dr. Finkel, who submitted one of these certifications in this case, is actually also an internist and a gastroenterologist. So there is actually somebody who is qualified in both of these areas, even though his certification doesn't spell that out, because this argument about how they have to be essentially unicorns, that they have to have both specialties, is something that they raised on appeal. The language in the statute speaks in the singular, specialty or subspecialty. That language has meaning. I agree with giving every word effect. The key is that you have to give the word effect as it's written, not as we wish it was written, not as we wanted to have it written, as it's written, and it's written in the singular. And while I appreciate Justice Albin's decision in Nicholas, I also appreciate Justice Albin's decision in Buck versus Henry. That decision came down 13 years ago. That language concerning the overlapping specialties issue or problem has been there that entire time. And in the ensuing 13 years, the legislature has found it fit not to amend the statute and overturn Buck versus Henry. That also has meaning. It has significance for the reasons that the Chief Justice articulated with respect to it being a principled statement of law. The rule in Buck is clear, it's workable, and it has worked. If you are practicing in multiple specialty areas and you are wearing a panoply of hats, fine. But if you deviate from the standard of care in one, you are liable, or can be found liable, if a fact finder agrees. That is the rule that runs through outer jurisprudence of tort law, and there is nothing in the text of the Patients First Act or the Affidavit of Merit statute when it was originally passed or its legislative history to indicate that the legislature wanted to have this broad departure from traditional tort. They wanted a more robust scientific basis for these claims. The plaintiffs in this case have met that. They have submitted an affidavit of merit from an internist saying that Dr. Goyal deviated from the standard of care in his capacity as an internist. And the reason that's important is because Dr. Goyal himself says, he has said in his answer that, yes, I was practicing in my specialties as an internist and a gastroenterologist. But you can't ignore the first part of that. The sheer fact that he was practicing in an adjoining or a subspecialty does not excuse him from meeting the standard of care in the primary specialty. And for
one quick question, what is your recollection of when defendants first raised the issue or started making the argument that one individual specializing in internal medicine and gastroenterology had to provide the AOM? Mr. Tam indicated during his argument that that's their argument today, and that would not have been their argument prior to today. But what is your recollection of when that argument first arose? Because you said that Dr. Finkel's certification did not specifically mention that he was also an internist and a gastroenterologist, because that was not the issue at that time.
Right. So I know from co-counsel, because I didn't have this case until after it came out of the appellate division. But I know from co-counsel that this issue about having a person who specializes in both was not something that was raised at the Ferreira conference. It was not something that appears anywhere in the appellate division's decision with respect to it being an explicit argument. And so when we saw it in their briefs, we said, well, wow, this is really a radical departure, because what you're asking us to do.
Sorry, which briefs? Only the briefs before this court, you're saying?
Yes.
Okay.
And so it seemed like a radical departure, because now what we're dealing with is somebody who's saying, well, if my doctor says I was specializing in four areas when I was treating somebody, that now we have to go find a unicorn. And if not, we have to fall back on this waiver provision. The problem with the waiver provision is that, as Justice Patterson said, that's what you rely on if you can't meet the affidavit of merit statute's requirements. We believe we did. The other problem with it is that when you're relying on a fallback provision, there's always that risk that you're going to fall through. And with catastrophic consequences, we're talking about dismissal with prejudice. And if those are the consequences that a plaintiff could potentially face, then I think it's incumbent upon the legislature to make clear that if you are practicing in multiple areas as a physician or treating physician, then the plaintiff has to then have affidavits of merit that addresses each and every single one. They didn't do that in the statute itself. And again, as I indicated, there's been more than a decade since Buck and that language in Buck, and they've sought fit not to do that as well.
Thank you, counsel. And thank you to all counsel for the helpful arguments. We're going to take the matter under advisement.